Dear listeners and jazz lovers, my name is Jochen Axer, and today I'm particularly happy about my guest, one of the best Trident and swing piano player with Grammy nomination and Steinway artist, and also well known with her own show distributed by radio stations in the USA, the National Public Radio, for example, an interview series she started before the existence of any podcast 22 years ago. I welcome you very warmly, Judy Carmichael.
I'm glad to be here.
Dear Judy, regularly it's you who interviews people. Today we want to do it the other way around. And regularly, one of your first questions is, what jazz record or project has most influenced and inspired your guest? I want to ask this question the same way, maybe with the addition of how did you get into ragtime or swing or stride piano? And was there any influence by parents, friends, other guys and people? What about that?
I think the most important thing is having someone around who makes music, who introduces you to what fun it is and how great it is and how joyous it is. And my parents did that. There was always music in the house in terms of them playing. My dad sang. There was lots of, if there was a party, everybody was singing around the piano. And there was a lovely, doesn't matter if you're good, just have fun with it, which I think is really important. So that would be the earliest. And then I was a fan of early musicals, so I listened to that, whatever they were. When I was a little kid, I loved Shirley Temple movies because they had, I didn't think they have great music. I realize now it was the music I was drawn to. And all those Fred Astaire movies, Eleanor Powell, all the early 30s and 40s. So that's what really got me going. So that drew me to this style of music. And then I heard a Count Basie record when he was, before he was Count Basie, when he was Bill Basie with the Benny Moten Band and was playing more what people associate with Fats Waller, more a style, much more, much denser pianistically, full on stride. And that's what inspired me to play this style.
Oh, great. Well, I know, I read about it, that you played piano 5 times a week. during years at Disneyland,
yeah,
especially also to fund your interview series, as I understood that, in jazz inspired. Did you ever regret doing that for years? Probably in that duration, only for financial reasons.
Nobody has ever asked me that. Now I always mention Disneyland. I love this. I always mention Disneyland. When I do classes, when I do master classes for young people, you know, if I'm in an elementary school or something, because I tell them I'm still really close with Mickey Mouse and that we still text all the time. So they're very impressed. That's the big, Mickey Mouse is the biggest fan, you know, the biggest star there is, of course. So, no, nobody's ever asked if I've regretted that. It's so interesting. It was very difficult. I was playing 5 days a week, usually 7 hours a day of solo piano. And there were breaks in there, but it can be very boring. But in a very American phrase or a jazz musician phrase, we called that a big chops gig, C-H-O-P-S, meaning that my technique got very strong because I was playing outside. Mm-hmm. So, and in California, they never admit it's cold. So it'd be like 45 in the morning and 80, you know, at the end of the day. So I got very good at knowing how to sustain everything physically. I got very strong because nobody would practice that long. And so I don't regret any of it. It was fantastic. I met amazing musicians. I was quite young. And back when I was there, they were hiring lots of music. They don't hire as many musicians now. So I heard great musicians. So it was difficult. But I'm quite proud of it. I'm the first woman, too, that the Disney organization ever hired.
You were the first woman who did that?
They didn't have any other women instrumentalists.
I see.
So I was in a dressing room with 10 men because they didn't have a dressing room where I was. So
okay.
I didn't, certainly okay. Didn't regret that.
Well, things have changed a little bit.
Yeah, loads of women musicians around now, but there weren't to that extent, especially playing jazz, and they'd never hired anybody for my position. I got the position because I could sound, because I, as I say, I was young, I could smile all day, and I could play very fast. It wasn't a job for ballads.
Have you any idea how many people you
I saw
contacted?
Oh yeah, well, it was 60,000 people came a day, so I was seeing a lot of people walking by.
So we can calculate that.
Yeah, no, it was a lot. It was a lot, and people. It's a very small group of us who played that position. And some of your audience will remember who Karen and Richard Carpenter, the Carpenters, an early pop group. He even had that Richard Carpenter played piano there many years ago. So a lot of it's a little special group of people who had that gig. I'm proud of it, quite proud of it.
Right. Let's move on to your radio show, through which I also got to know you, jazz inspired. How did you come up with this idea, and what was your real motivation? It's striking that you don't interview mainly jazz musicians, but a lot of other people, artists, and so on. Mm. What was the idea behind that?
It was a couple of different things. That it was one, that so many people, unfortunately, hear one jazz example, one jazz musician, one jazz group, one jazz record, don't like it and think they hate jazz. I've heard that over and over, not realizing that jazz is this broad field with something for almost everybody in it. And unlike pop music, it might not grab you right away. Some will, some, but it's a sophisticated art that is actually more enjoyable. The more you hear it, the more you listen. And so my original idea is if I could invite some famous, well-known names of different artists to talk about why they love jazz, that maybe people would give it a chance. If they heard Robert Redford saying why he liked it, and they knew Robert Redford and they liked him, they thought, oh, I'll listen to this. Or if they knew Billy Joel and found out that he had studied with Lenny Tristano and that he was a great jazz fan, maybe they'd give it a chance. That was part of the reason. And I also wanted to gather these professionally creative people. I knew what inspiring the conversations would be between the two of us, two artists, having this conversation. And it also gave me a chance to feature people that I knew were great, but they're not household names, would never get an hour feature on National Public Radio. So that gave me a chance to do that. That was my thinking.
Okay. Right. So you reacted to the fact that many people don't have, let's say, direct access to jazz, or at least react to the keyword jazz in a frightened or dismissive way.
Yeah.
From your point of view, how does that happen? Can it be changed? And how do you have the impression that you have success with your engagement in this area?
I think that one of the big problems, obviously, is it isn't played on the radio. I can only speak to America. It isn't as accessible. So people discover these things usually through the radio. Mm-hmm. That used to be how it was. Or when jazz was the popular music, people had it at dances and things like that. That doesn't happen as much. So jazz is most often introduced to people by a jazz fan, whether it's a friend or it's a relative, and then they get hooked. So I think that certainly a club like yours that draws such a wide variety of ages, which is great. You know, I was here last night and people said it was the first time they'd ever heard jazz. And that really speaks to the fact that this is very accessible and they feel they can give it a try, which is nice. And I think that making it available, I think that jazz musicians, it is incumbent on us to welcome the audience and not assume that they know anything. I don't assume that the audience knows who Peggy Lee is. Why should they? Mm-hmm. You know, that's a long time ago. So I think that jazz musicians need to work a bit harder at making it more accessible, welcoming people in, not assuming they know anything, and not making people feel bad if they don't. Saying, because I'm basically up here saying, I love this music, let me welcome you in to the party. And so that's how I think. And that's how I've done it. I've gotten a broader audience because I've reached out to a lot of people who have never heard jazz. So that's how I've done it.
Okay. On the other side, jazz is definitely global music, but its roots are clearly African-American. From your point of view, the American point of view, do the different jazz styles distance or even alienate themselves from each other? Do you feel that the European jazz in particular is now very independent and wants to be understood as its own art and art form? And is there any interest in the States towards the European or especially the German jazz scene?
I think it's more inclusive of, I don't hear people talking about, and I can only really speak to the American experience,
right.
But I think that it's just how someone plays. I think in early years it would be that they thought the Americans were better at it, mm-hmm. and because we came up with it. And I don't think of it as just an African-American experience. I think one of the great things about jazz, and I say this as an American, is that I think that it could only have been born in America. And the reason I say that is because America is such a mix of things. And we were, if you think about jazz, it really took European classical music. It took Broadway, the book from Broadway of those tunes, which were mostly Jewish mm-hmm. writers. So you have that. You have the European instruments, you have the European classical basis of all of it. Then you have the African rhythms, the Cajun rhythms, and it all mixes together, which at its best is the American experience. And a jazz group, I think of as an epitome of that, because America, as an American, you're brought up as it's all about your individual expression, which is what it is in jazz, and then the collective cooperation to make the band work. We sometimes in America are a little bit more challenged with the collective cooperation, but we are all about that individual expression. So I think in the early days of jazz, they would say definitely you can tell the difference. The Americans are the ones with the sound, but that's, I don't find that way at all anymore. It's how does a person play? Okay. Do they play great? And that's really how they're looking. It doesn't matter where they're from.
Okay, we do have a series which we call New York Jazz. I only want to ask in this context, is that really true to say, okay, that's the middle of jazz in the States? Or is it New Orleans or whatever?
Oh, we're going to go down that road. I love it. New Orleans.
You, what's your sense of?
Well, you know, it's there's a great quote from one of our past mayors, Ed Koch. He said, if you're one in a million, there's 10 of you in New York.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And it's kind of true. The people that really want to be tested, and they come, myself included, that you go to see, because you can be the best in your town and you're not even in the top 30 in New York. Mm-hmm. And even the New Orleans people, if you think about the famous New Orleans, John Batiste, Wynton Marsalis, they live in New York. And okay. So it's a different thing. And New Orleans is fabulous. It has a great history.
Of course.
Talk about a mix of all different things. And they have a wonderful tradition of carrying on the tradition. But it's pretty narrow in its focus on it being New Orleans music, to where in New York it's not that way. And it's not about being American. It's about being a New Yorker. And that can mean you're from Germany, you're from Australia, yeah. But you're at that New York experience and you've put yourself out there.
Okay. So we use the right title. Well, coming back, in of course, in Germany and elsewhere, jazz is a niche. Your aim is to win listeners for jazz through your interviews with interesting people. Well, I think at King Georg we try a similar approach by focusing on straight ahead jazz, doing it in high quality and occasionally adding modern or contemporary jazz. What is, from your point of view, apparently so difficult, even in the US, to get a broad audience interested in jazz, a really broad audience, not only the nerds.
Not only the nerds. I think accessibility. I think that it's like all great art. It isn't, very often it isn't immediate. I always use the example, we have a magazine called People Magazine. Mm-hmm. And it's got pretty people on the cover. And so you're always drawn to it immediately. And I look at it like junk food. And there's a place for that. Like I love an ice cream cone and it gives me an instant burst. And there it is, but I can't have it for every meal. It isn't going to sustain me. And it may take you just a little bit more to pick up that Nabokov novel, but it's going to make you smarter when you read it. And I think that's what jazz is. I think that there's a little bit extra to get started with it sometimes. So I think that that's what, I don't think it, that's what keeps it from being this massively appealing kind of for big stadiums or something. But then you take somebody like Lady Gaga, who is a full-on jazz person. She loves jazz. And so, but she got famous for a meat suit, you know, an entirely different thing. But she plays it and people like it. Mm-hmm. Or you have somebody like it that you just had here, Samara Joy, who is a full-on jazz person, but she's big on TikTok. And I asked her that. I said, is this going to bring more people to jazz? I don't think it'll bring a lot more people. Bring a lot more people to Samara Joy, but I think it will bring some other people. I think that it will, because she has a bigger outreach, that people will. But I think that it's a little more challenging, but it also, it certainly makes for some great jazz musicians, because not everybody can do it.
That's really true. Okay, well, my impression is that there is a, well, great interest in the German jazz area. People who talk about jazz or think about jazz, as far as the US American style and artists are concerned, is it the other way around? Similar? Do you think that from your point of view, the American point of view, are they interested in the European jazz? Or is it more or less the focus on U.S. standards?
No, I don't think so, because I think part of, and it's very dangerous to make these generalizations, but I'll go ahead and do it. America is so huge that people can spend their entire lives in America and not feel that they need to go anywhere else, because you could spend your whole life just exploring that spot. And I think that they don't... not as many people look outward in that regard, to where here, one of the things that most people know is that America invented jazz. And I know that I benefit from that, that people will come in and say, oh, it's an American jazz musician, let's check it out. We know that it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily better, but I think people want to see that. And something I want to mention, that I'm jumping in here and I'm taking over your interview, but I was so impressed with your audiences. And as a performer, you know, there's an arc of applause, of how a long pause usually goes on. And after every single tune, the people kept applauding. And I felt that real engagement in the music. And it's wonderful. It's absolutely fabulous to have them that enthusiastic.
Hopefully this will be even better this evening, because, of course, every ticket is sold out. So
I can't imagine it being better. You were here. It was amazing. It was just went on and on. I told them we'd still be playing if I hadn't stopped the encores, you know.
Okay. Well, inspiration is your keyword.
Yes.
You have certainly opened the door to people with your commitment. And you deserve the greatest respect for that. I sincerely hope that you will continue your interviews for decades to come, and that will continue to inspire people for jazz. And with your permission, we will keep referring to your talks and publications. And for those who have already caught fire, your recently published book, Great Inspirations, is highly recommended.
Thank you.
Perhaps you will mention some of the names of your interviews, whose conversations I produced in this book, but which can also be heard on your website and on Spotify and other platforms.
What was
this
broad one of my favorites, certainly somebody that I grew up with seeing his movies, was Robert Redford. That was one of my early ones that I wanted to interview, mainly because he's done so much for the film industry and for creativity, and which are the kind of people I like to have on the show. He's the one who started the Sundance Film Festival, of course. All of his movies have had great meaning, and I knew that he was inspired by jazz. So he was one of the ones I really liked. Glenn Close was quite interesting. She, I didn't know, was a jazz fan and found out that she'd done a jazz project at Jazz at Lincoln Center. Roy Scheider, I'm just thinking of actors. Roy Scheider, who some of your listeners, he was a stage actor, which is how I knew him, but he was also the one who was, we need a bigger boat in Jaws. So he was great. I'm trying to think of other people that were real favorites. I had mentioned to you, I'm a fan of astrophysics, and there Neil deGrasse Tyson is quite well known in the States. He was on the Big Bang Theory a lot, but he's the head of our main planetarium in New York, the Hayden Planetarium. So we got to talk astrophysics and music and the connection between math and music. I like all of that. So that was fun. But it's a wide range, and Billy Joel was great. My hilarious thing with Billy Joel is he said how much he loved lunch, so he would only do the interview if we had lunch. So we started out like kind of an awkward blind date, and two bottles of wine, and 3 hours later, we were two drunk musicians hanging out. So that was really fun, and he was great. Loved it. So that was fun. Yeah.
Great. Well, how many people did you interview or had in your interviews up
there's
to now?
Hundreds. I don't even know. It's a weekly show, and this is my 23rd year, and I started recording 2 years before it was actually on air. So a long time.
Okay.
It's a lot of people.
And you did it a fortnight or every week?
I would do it because I travel so much. I was able to do it either at the BBC when I was in London, so I'd get my English people. And when I was in Australia, I'd do the Aussies there. And then either New York or Los Angeles, because I'd be in those places. And so it sort of technology has been on my side. Because when I started, I had to do it in a studio. I didn't have portable equipment. Right. Then I had to pay for satellite uplink, which is like $10,000 a year for me to upload the show to the satellite for the stations to download it. And then things got smaller and more portable. And so I was able to, it's been, like I say, technology's been on my side. It's made it all easier.
Great. Okay, among other things, you have immortalized a quote from the jazz pianist John Eaton in your book, who, and I'm afraid that it remains with his assessment, which wonderfully describes the ambivalence of all people who are committed to or practice jazz. Being a jazz musician is an awful way to make a living, but it's a wonderful thing to do with your life.
Isn't that great?
I think it's your approach as well.
It is. It is. And he spontaneously said that. He just said it. And it was such a great line that I had to put it in there. I thought it was wonderful.
Okay. Judy, I hope that many people will listen to your interviews. It's always fun. It's very interesting. You are extremely open-minded. It's always a laughter in between. So, many thanks for your coming, for the time you took for this interview, for the great concerts you give around the world and during these 2 days in King York. Thank you very, very much, Judy Carmichael.
Thank you for having me.